Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, March 30th, 2020. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio and working from his home studio, our producer, Taylor Schwenk. Some news and notes before we get to Kyle Peterson and Sarah Langs to talk about the potential impact of some of the new rules that have been agreed to by Major League Baseball and the Players Association. Two Cubs game day employees who attended a March 8th training session at Wrigley Field have tested positive for the coronavirus, the team confirmed on Sunday. On Friday, the owners ratified that agreement with the players to address salary and service time issues amid the indefinite delay to the start of the regular season. This, according to ESPN and multiple reports. Among those changes, possibly reducing the draft to as few as five rounds this year with a cap of $20,000 in bonuses spent on any undrafted free agent. This drew a strong reaction from agent Scott Boras, who told USA Today, "You're sending a message to drafted players. You are Major League Baseball's stepchild. It's unconscionable to me for that small amount of money. We're talking about a whopping $6 million savings over the whole damn draft." And we'll be talking with Kyle Peterson about that in a moment. But first, one last thing before we get to Kyle and Sarah to talk about the implications of that draft agreement. Check out today's episode of ESPN Daily. We don't know when baseball will return, but let's dream about its future. Reds pitcher Trevor Bauer gets real with MLB insider Jeff Passan on how MLB can make the most of its comeback. That's ESPN Daily. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. Kyle Peterson, a former pitcher who is, he describes, talks baseball on ESPN and the SEC Network, and he talked to us from Omaha. Kyle, I think it's important every day to say out loud what you and I both know, that, hey, there are a lot more important things going on in the world than baseball right now. This is what we do. It's a baseball podcast, but we certainly want to recognize that there are other things going on.
Yeah, without a doubt. To that point, though, I think it is important to still talk through some of this stuff, because it's everybody needs an outlet through this while also hopefully keeping a firm handle as to how serious all this is. And it's, you know, obviously it varies by location. I'm in Omaha, and things are a little bit more controlled right here, at least a fair amount more controlled right here. But we all realize that can spin pretty quick. So it's upon all of us to take care of each and every one of us all the way through this.
All right, let's talk about the proposed changes to the draft. It's not totally clear what Major League Baseball is going to do about this year's draft in terms of exactly how many rounds and exactly when it's going to take place. But as Jeff Passan reported, the details are that the draft could be cut back to as few as five rounds. And then if you're an undrafted free agent, the most that you can make with a signing bonus would be $20,000. What was your reaction when you heard the broad strokes of what's going to happen here?
Well, I was kind of split. I mean, my biggest fear was that they wouldn't have a draft. And my understanding is that was discussed. And thankfully, that didn't happen. I think my understanding of it, and it's in line with what Jeff has reported, is that essentially there's a floor in rounds this year, and the floor is five. And the ceiling can be whatever, I think, whatever Major League Baseball wants to make it. I think it's realistic to think it, you know, the most it would probably go is 10. It's so far reaching, and it's extremely far reaching in a college game. First and foremost, eligibility, which is supposed to be decided today by a council of administrators across Division I. But you got seniors and juniors, and really everybody sitting at home right now trying to figure out, do I have an extra year of eligibility? For seniors, do I even have anywhere to play next year? And obviously for juniors, do I have any leverage left? And, you know, am I going to go back and be a junior? Then at the college level, you're dealing with timing on the draft, because you got to remember there's roster limits in college baseball. And so if there are five rounds and there are free agent signings that cap out at 20,000, the reality is there's going to be a significant number of college guys going back to college. And more by probably 8 to 10 at each school than, not each, but at most schools, than you would expect on a yearly basis. With a roster limit of 35, we need to do something about that, because it's going to create a situation that ultimately is not good for the kids. I understand we all have to adjust through this. I get it. But some flexibility at this point would be a good idea.
When I was in contact with Tim Corbin, the Vanderbilt coach, about this, he said that he felt like it was important. And my question to him was about the idea of having no draft this year. He said, look, we need to keep things moving. Yeah. It's important that we keep things moving along. How do you feel about that?
Totally agree. I mean, there's a fluidity to this that needs to continue. And obviously it's going to slow. And I think that's understandable given the environment that we're all in, both from a health standpoint and from a pure economic standpoint. But to just put the absolute brakes on it, while I understand there would be a lot of financial benefit to Major League Baseball, it would be crushing the kids that are in college right now and the top line high school guys. But really the juniors and the seniors that are in college right now. And, you know, historically, and this isn't an NCAA only decision, it's more the administrators that'll make the decision, but they haven't been terribly flexible when it comes to college baseball. This is an area that they need to be. And just to allow this process to work its way through the system with the understanding that the draft is different this year, and it sounds like the draft is different next year. So I totally agree with Corbs. I think in this case, the draft allows just a typical cycle to take place. And while the cycle is going to be different this year, I think that means that we need some more flexibility as far as numbers.
Now, what other points, specific points of flexibility do you think that college baseball, the NCAA could provide for college baseball? My initial thought, and I don't know it as well as you do, would be in the number of scholarships, how that becomes an enormous problem with kids not necessarily moving along through the draft.
It does. I mean, if you just really want to simplify it, there's 11.7 scholarships at the Division I level. It doesn't mean you have to give 11.7. You're allowed 11.7. And seeing as though we're going to roughly add another class, or at least hopefully add another class, and we'll get back to that in a minute. I think from a scholarship standpoint, if you just increased it by 25% for 2 years, or even go 25% and stair-step it down over the next two or three, that's fine. But understand that there needs to be some flexibility this year. The second thing, and from my standpoint, it's maybe more important than the scholarship number, is the roster limit. We have a roster limit at Division I baseball of 35 players. And that roster, as coaches get into the summer, they're assuming this natural flow that Corbs is talking about. Your seniors are going to graduate and move on. A number of juniors are going to get drafted and signed, and that's always a shell game to figure out how many. And then ultimately, especially at the higher levels, you know that you're going to lose some high school kids. So if you sign a class of 10 high school kids, two or three of them may sign. Well, when you limit a draft the way that it is this year, that two or three may turn into one or none. Obviously, if seniors gain their eligibility back, and not all of them come back, but a lot of them will, then they're back into the system and more juniors come back than they otherwise would have because there's not as many draft spots. So for that, I think if you take the roster limit up, call it 43 to 45, and again, stair-step that back down if, in fact, you need to do that. But college coaches, from a baseball standpoint, are in a different position than literally any other sport. Because let's just assume for a minute that the draft is held July 1st and the signing date is August 1st. Well, you really don't know who you have coming to campus until after that signing date. Doesn't matter where they're drafted, it doesn't mean they're going to sign. And so college coaches this year, in some cases, could have 2 weeks to literally figure out, okay, I thought X, Y, and Z were coming back. They're not. Or exactly the opposite. I thought X, Y, and Z were going to sign, and they're not going to sign. Now I got to play the scholarship shell game. I got to play the roster limit shell game, and I got to do it all in 15 days. That's where we need flexibility. And I think everybody needs to look at this as rare a situation it is and give some.
So what would you think is the optimal date for baseball to hold the draft now in your eyes?
I think it's so uncertain, Buster. You know, I don't. If we're only going five rounds, the reality is they had a lot of their work done on that level of the draft anyway. And so whether you have it in the middle of June or the 1st of July, to me, the more important date when it comes to how this thing works is through the system is when the signing date is. It can't be too tight in that if you have a mid-July draft and you only have 2 weeks to negotiate, you know, that's not a comfortable position for anybody to be in. So I think there needs to be a realistic negotiating period. So let's say the first or second week of July with a signing date of August 1st. I hope they do everything they can. And my understanding is that August 1st date is one that's been agreed upon. But I hope to do everything they can to keep that August 1st date. And if you can push it back and push it into July, that's even more beneficial. So that would be my ideal is the draft as soon as I would say is commercially reasonable. and then a signing date that is no later than August 1st.
All right, let's look at it from Major League Baseball's perspective. When I first heard about the rules that they have in place, my initial thought was, my goodness, there are going to be so many Major League caliber players that we'll never see reach that level. Perhaps not even in professional baseball because of the spending cap on players after those first five rounds or whatever. Whatever they get to, but the idea that you could, if you're a player who in the past could have gotten a larger signing bonus, the most you can get is $20,000. I'm thinking that there are going to be a number of people who are going to say, you know what, I can't make that work, especially in light of what we're seeing with the national economy and people having to make choices about, supporting their families or supporting themselves. And I'm thinking about, a guy like Jacob deGrom, who was chosen in the ninth round by the Mets. Based on a couple of appearances that their scouts saw in Albany, Georgia. I'm thinking about, a guy like Kevin Kiermaier, who was a late-round pick, a Matt Adams out of Slippery Rock. There are going to be a lot of those guys who basically say, this can't work for me. What do you think?
Albert Pujols. I mean, the list is long of the guys that went after, in this case, where the draft would actually be, that went after the fifth round. I totally agree with you, and to my point, Buster, I think it works hand in hand with flexibility at the collegiate level. So where I would like all these guys to get an extra year because I think it's only fair. With saying that, I fully understand that there's financial challenges that are going to go with that. And so it doesn't, it doesn't mean that everybody comes back in a full ride, because Lord knows colleges and athletic departments are going to be in the same financial pinch that the rest of us are going to be when we get through this thing. But you're right. For the guy that was going to go in the seventh or the eighth round, that before ninth round, even guys after that, I don't know that guy signs this year. And to your point, even greater, does that guy continue to play if you don't give him an extra year of eligibility? Where do you go? There gets to be a life reality that goes into this. And, you can only pause the reality of life so long if you're playing minor league baseball, because you're not making enough money to truly say that you're making a living. That's the unfortunate part of this. And that's where I would hope that flexibility comes in to really give it another year to get through the system. And so that kid that you just talked about, that the Grimes of the world, that in a situation like a five round draft wouldn't have really any main reason to sign, next year have the ability to have a draft that say goes 20 or 25 rounds. And it flows more normally than it otherwise would. We need a year of flexibility in this thing.
Kyle, I really felt like, too, when I saw these rules, I'm like, look, I get it. If you're a small market team like the Pirates or the Cleveland Indians, because of the financial uncertainty that we're going to have going forward, the financial costs that these teams are going to incur, I get the fact that they don't want to take on a lot of signing bonuses. So you understand why they would ask for this. And you can understand, you can understand why they might want to limit the draft to affect that, or, change the schedule for how these bonuses are going to get paid out. But I really don't think that there was enough advocacy on behalf of the amateur players in this process to limit the drafts. But also, it felt like that by limiting the spending to $20,000, to capping that on the undrafted players, that to me is also a little bit of CYA going on with the team, saying, look, we don't want to spend the money, but we also want to make sure that there aren't mistakes that we make that other teams take advantage of because they're big market teams. I think there needs to be more advocacy for the players. What about you?
Well, yeah. So let me hit this a few different ways. To your last CYA comment, I totally agree. And it goes back to when the draft pool got put into place. It was for the very same reason. The draft pool was put into place, so in essence, there was a salary cap on the draft. And if you went above the salary cap, there were significant penalties that went along with it. This capping $20,000 for free agents is the exact same thing. I mean, it's to avoid the, we're going to slide Jimmy Joe through the draft, and we know that when he gets to free agency, we've already got a side deal, and we're going to sign it for $100,000 or whatever the number is. So I totally agree with you. On the advocacy piece, I would say this. Would I like it to be different? Hell yes, I'd like it to be different. I don't know that the draft needed to be 40 rounds anyway, so somewhere between 20 and 30 seems to make sense to me. But at the same time, I do want to give Tony Clark a little bit of credit in this, because the reality is they were fighting for something that ultimately it's not dues paying guys that is benefiting from it right now. And I understand there's a greater good to this that needs to be involved. But at the same time, this would have been theoretically an easy give from a players association standpoint to ultimately pump more money into the guys that are at the major league, or at least those that are on the 40 man. So would I like it to be more? Absolutely. I would like it to be more. That being said, I do appreciate how they pushed. And just in having some discussions that I've had over the last week to 10 days, I know that there was a push. And I know that ultimately what was being proposed from the major league side is not what we see right now. It could have been significantly worse for the amateur player. Is it ideal? No. Is it as bad as it could have been? No, not even close.
Now, what I'm going to say here is like asking for something that I know will never happen. And that I really feel like this would have been a great year for Major League Baseball, for the Player Association to agree to a 1 or 2 year window where teams were allowed to trade draft picks. Like if you're the Cleveland Indians, you're the Pirates, maybe you don't want to line up the large signing bonuses attached to these picks, and you're worried about the money that you might give up. This would have been the year to me where, you know what, if you have a second round or a second pick in the draft or third pick in the draft and you want to make sure you get value for it, then you could flip it for future assets. And then trade to a team like the Yankees or the Dodgers, if that's what you felt like you needed to do. I think that would have been a better solution than what they came up with. What do you think?
I think both is fine. You know, yeah. I mean, I think that to have, and I think what you just proposed should be in place anyway. I mean, it exists in all the other major sports drafts. Why it doesn't exist in baseball, I still don't totally understand. I mean, I think that, listen, man, and in reality, we have an opportunity in basically all areas of our life to really sit back and look and go, okay, what have we wanted to do that we've never been able to do? Because Lord knows we got more time on our hands now, more time to think about it than we ever have. And the draft is just one of those. And I fully agree with you. I think it's a time within the game and it's a time within the draft to really take a look at it and say, what are some other things that we think would be beneficial changes moving forward? And I wholeheartedly agree. The ability to trade draft picks, especially in the environment that we're in right now, just seems to benefit everybody.
I wrote a piece on Sunday about different entities in the sport. Benefit is not the right word, but are going to be harmed less than others. And to me, it's clear that the group of players that's going to get absolutely pounded are the guys who have 4+, 5+ years of service time or arbitration eligible for the second and third time and for the players on 1 year contracts. Because as we look ahead, I think you would agree with me that whenever the dust settles, you're going to see a number of teams decide, you know what, we have to cut payroll for the money lost, for projected losses going forward. And you and I both know that the young, cheap players, they're not going to lose out. The teams are going to keep those players because they don't have to pay them anything. And then you have the guys in multi-year deals, you know, Garrett Cole, a Mike Trout. Those obligations will remain in place. And that means that the area where teams are going to be looking to save money are in those guys on short-term, non-guaranteed deals. And for example, and I wrote about the case of Noah Syndergaard, who under normal circumstances, we could easily predict what his trajectory is going to be. He just had Tommy John surgery. If it goes well, he could come back early in the 2021 season, maybe midway through the 2021 season. But now, if you're the New York Mets, at the end of this year, Marcus Stroman and Michael Wacha and Rick Porcello are all going to be free agents. 3/5 of your rotation, they're going to move on. And what you have in place for your 2021 rotation are Jacob deGrom under a long-term deal, Steven Matz, who's going to be in his last year before free agency, and you potentially could have Noah Syndergaard making about $10 million. But here's the thing. We don't know how his rehabilitation is going to go. Kyle, you know far better than I do. A lot of times when guys have Tommy John, they might have a blip in their rehabilitation. Maybe they're backed up. So the Mets, as we sit here today, they don't know if he's going to give them 80 innings or 100 innings or 120 innings next year, which means that their decision in the fall about what to do with him becomes very complicated, because then you're basically saying, look, do we want to bet $10 million on a guy who might pitch half a season, might pitch 4 months, he might pitch less, he might pitch more before he goes into free agency? And I've had evaluators with other teams say, That's a guy who, you know, maybe you look to flip him for value. Maybe you bet on him and keep him. Maybe you non-tender him because of the what it's expected to be a much wider pool of talent for guys with 4+, 5+ years of service time, maybe getting non-tendered. What do you think?
Yeah, I think your point of of that particular subset of guys, so those that are last year arbitration eligible would push into free agency the following year. That's where the toughest decisions are going to be made because obviously it's real money. But at the same time, there's uncertainty as far as return in what is a very short period of time. Because clearly once you get to once you get through arbitration and become a free agent, the control's entirely gone aside from, you know, getting a protected draft pick if you tender a guy a contract. So I agree, and I think it's a really important and interesting point to bring up right now. The guys that were on 1 year deals and those that are at the back end of arbitration eligible, especially those coming off an injury like Syndergaard, it falls squarely into the category of in many cases we haven't been here before. This one though is a little bit different because I mean teams have decisions like this to make every year. Theoretically, you know, if Syndergaard was coming back next year and you're not quite sure, let's say he's going to be, you think he's going to be ready May 1st or June 1st or name your date. In any other year, I think you would look at it differently, but particularly in a year that most teams are going to have to look at payroll a little bit different. I think the challenge is, Buster, what's the solve? And I don't necessarily know what the solve is other than just to let the market do what the market generally does in Major League Baseball. What I'm fairly confident is, if Syndergaard shows the ability, or I mean, name your player, whoever it is, shows the ability to come back and be able to help a major league team next year, there is going to be a market there somewhere. Now, what that market is, I guess that's something we're going to have to figure out next year. But it's hard to go reproduce 97, 98 and have the pure stuff that he had before he got hurt. The one thing, too, I think there's a, and I'm not saying that you did it because you didn't at all, but I think there's a misnomer within, I would say, the greater fan base, that everybody comes back stronger from Tommy John. That's not what happens. There are plenty to do. It's still a complicated one surgery, but what's most important is it's a complicated and really rigorous rehab schedule. And that's the key, is the rehab schedule all the way through and the ability to maintain that gives you the best chance to come through. But just this automatic assumption that, well, I mean, Tommy John, guys are going to come back stronger. Not necessarily. And not necessarily on any time frame that in this case would make it beneficial for the Mets next year.
Yeah, 100%, which really complicates their decision. Here's another thing, too, that I wrote about that, you know, compared the current situation to what happened in the spring of 1995. As you remember, the player strike was settled. Teams went back to spring training. But for some teams, there was a lot of concern about the financial fallout. And if you remember that spring, the Montreal Expos, who arguably the best team in baseball in 1994, tremendous talent on that team. They basically dumped a bunch of players in anticipation of financial losses to come. And I thought about it from the perspective of a team, you know, like the Cleveland Indians. Okay. We know that they made the decision going into spring training that they're keeping Francisco Lindor, who's two seasons away from free agency. Now we don't know if they're going to have an opportunity to market him and to get proper value. And we don't know what their financial losses are going to be, but I suspect that like the Expos in 1995, there are going to be cases that when the starting gun goes off, whether it's this summer or whether it's during the course of the winter, there are going to be franchises anticipating losses that will just look to dump players, kind of like what we've seen in the stock market.
Yeah. Myself and a few other partners own a commercial real estate firm in Omaha. And late last week, we built the, okay, worst case scenario, middle ground, best case scenario, as far as just the way that we think we're going to come through this thing from a business standpoint. I have to think that major league organizations do the exact same thing. And the reality is, which you hit on earlier, some have more, significantly more financial flexibility than others when you get into a position like this. And so, sure, can it potentially be the haves and the have-nots as far as those that can hold on and not even hold on, but those that can add when you come out of this thing, and those that look at it and say, hey, we were on the way to a rebuild anyway. Now we're going all in rebuild because there's still going to be a market. I mean, for the Lindors of the world. And obviously the Betts situation to me is fascinating, to where you're the Dodgers and make the trade that you do and ultimately get, I mean, potentially no return from an on-field standpoint. with Mookie Betts, given that service time is going to carry through this thing in the revised collective bargaining agreement. So, yeah, there's so many facets to this thing, man. There's so many different facets to it. From a business standpoint, from a life standpoint, all the above. I wish we could just fast forward to stability, whatever stability looks like. And then obviously this stuff starts sorting itself out pretty quick.
Yeah, just an example of what the Expos did in the spring of 95. Think about this now that we have the full context. That spring, as they were looking to cut payroll, they decided not to tender one of their veteran players, Larry Walker, who will be inducted into the Hall of Fame at some point this year. That's how draconian their cuts were. Last one for you. You made reference to the idea of sort of reimagining the product, reimagining baseball as we go forward. At the major league level, what form would you like that to take? Because I've had that conversation with some players, with some executives who say, look, this is, in a sense, because of the downtime, it's an opportunity to create a product that we like.
Oh, man. That's a good one to end on. I would tell you this. I think that we got way obsessed, and from a TV product and from a fan base product standpoint, it's a good thing. We got way obsessed with speed of game. And everything, so many things were aimed towards speed of game. You know, guys that come in, you got to face three hitters before you go out. I'm not a huge fan of that one. I'll tell you what I wouldn't be against is mixing in a seven-inning game on a Sunday every once in a while to speed it up. We've talked about that at the college level, specifically on a weekend, because that third game sometimes can be disastrous from a pitching standpoint. Obviously different at the major league level. More than anything, and I think this is what the sport is really going to need, this is the time to let your personality show within the game. This is the time to let the Stromans and the Alonzos and go right down the list of the guys that give them more of an opportunity to show personality. Buster, you saw it in spring training and we're a part of it. When we mic'd up guys in those spring training games, which at this point is all that we have for baseball this year, the feedback on that was massive. And I think it's incumbent upon the game and clearly upon the players, but the feedback that it seemed everybody was getting from the player standpoint is, hey, this is kind of fun. Can't do it every game. But more that we can showcase the personalities of these guys, the NBA does an unbelievable job of it. The NFL has done a much better job of it, while they can clearly do more. I think Major League Baseball could do a lot more. Let them wear whatever shoes they want to wear. Let the jerseys that get designed over the course of the players weekend or whatever it is, let that happen a few times a year. Let fans do it a few times. Just, you've really got to work on engagement when you come back from this, because we were already at a time to where the eyes on Major League Baseball, at least the age of those that were watching Major League Baseball, wasn't exactly getting younger. Now's the time to try and fire everything you got at it, because we're going to need to grow that fan base as quickly as we can. And I just think that if you highlight the personalities of our guys within the game, it's a real easy and it should be a positive way to grow that.
I completely agree, and I think you mentioned something that will be tested. This, in a sense, whenever baseball comes back, they will test that seven-inning games, which I think in 20 years is going to be the norm. This will be the first time that happens. All right, Kyle, I appreciate it. Stay safe.
Buster, be well. Good talking to you, man.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs is a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, first, I was just talking with Kyle Peterson about the proposed new draft rules, and they haven't been completely settled. But my reaction when I first saw them was, you know what? There are going to be a lot of potential major leaguers who we're never going to see. What are some examples in baseball about players who are late round picks who wound up going on beyond projections?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I think this is one of those really fun things, especially about baseball. You get it in other sports as well. We know Tom Brady was a late round pick. We know the famous picture of him and all that. But, you know, in baseball, especially, the draft used to be even more rounds than it is now. Now, had it not been, had these changes not been proposed, it would have been 40 rounds is what it's at right now. And it used to go into 60s and even more than that. So there's a lot of opportunity for these little, you know, baseball gems. And the number one that comes to mind is obviously Mike Piazza, who was drafted in the 62nd round as a favorite to Tommy Lasorda. And that's the latest draft pick to make the Hall of Fame, like the furthest from number one that anyone was taken to make the Hall of Fame. And Mike Piazza, of course, my favorite player growing up. But even There's a lot of others. I mean, Nolan Ryan was a 12th round pick. Wade Boggs was in the 7th round. Albert Pujols, very famously, in the 13th round. He's not in the Hall of Fame yet, but he certainly will be. And, you know, John Smoltz, Andy Pettitte were both in the 22nd round. And, you know, if you go to some other active players, not quite necessarily on Pujols level, but Anthony Rizzo was in the 6th round and Dallas Keuchel was in the 7th round. So, you know, and obviously the guys that you mentioned in your column on Sunday, DeGrom, Matt Carpenter, Paul Goldschmidt, Kevin Kiermaier were all in the 8th round or later. So, you know, there's just so many players in baseball. And I think that that's a lot of why you get so many late round picks who do turn into, whether it's outstanding players like some of the guys I mentioned, or even just, you know, solid players that you need on a roster.
Sarah, it's amazing how many stories there are about players who are sort of plucked out of obscurity because of one sighting by a scout. One of my favorite ones that I wrote about and covered remember the old left-handed reliever, Chris Hammond? Mm-hmm. He was in college. He told me this story about how in his last year at college, he was an outfielder. He was pitching for Gulf Coast Community College, and his coach told him, he said, "Hey, look, we're short on pitching. Can you start this game?" And he said, "Yeah, no problem." Well, he slept late that morning, and he nearly missed the team bus. And a teammate scrambled to wake him up, and he makes the team bus and he goes out and pitches that day. And as it turns out, one of the people in the stands for this, one of his very few college appearances as a pitcher, was a scout for the Cincinnati Reds. And the Reds round up taking him in the 6th round of the 1986 draft. And he goes on, you know, to have this, a 14-year career in the big leagues. Based on that one appearance, that's what I'm kind of worried about, that, you know, those type of stories, those type of trajectories are going to be interrupted by what's going on and the change in the draft rules. I wrote on Sunday about Noah Syndergaard, about how, to me, he's going to provide a window into what are going to be baseball's new economics, that, you know, the decision that's going to be about him by the Mets is going to reflect a lot of the changes that we're going to see going forward. What'd you think?
Yeah, no, I thought it was really interesting. And that was one of the things I thought about. And I think a lot of people were talking about when his Tommy John surgery was announced, was just how does that, you know, walk year or that would be next year and, you know, contract year, however you want to say, how does that change with the fact that he is going to be out for all of this time and with the fact that the team is going to be dealing with either having played a partial season or no season? We don't know exactly what's going to happen yet. And that, you know, there's a lot of money involved and, you know, the idea of recouping money and determining exactly how you want to approach your payroll. I'm very interested to see how this all plays out. I really can't envision exactly how it's going to go, but I do think that there are going to be decisions like you referred to about potentially more non-tenders and certain types of players in certain spots not really being, you know, in a great position moving forward. Guys who signed one-year deals for this year.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that's the group that's going to get pounded because, as I was talking about with Kyle, you know, the guys who are under existing contracts, long-term deals like Mike Trout, Garrett Cole, they're not going to be touched. Teams are obviously going to hoard their young players because they're cheap, but it is those guys on those non-guaranteed one-year deals in the 4 to 5 plus years of service time, guys on one-year contracts as free agents who are going to get hit. And I suspect that part of the calculus for teams is, look, if we non-tender a player, we can still fish from that. What we've seen is a growing pool of free agents that has developed in recent years because of non-tenders. What are some numbers behind that?
Yeah. So this year, the day after the World Series, there were 145 players that became free agents. So that's before the deadlines for opt-outs, and that's before non-tenders happen. In 2018, so after the 2018 season, there were 131. So that's already an increase. And then when you look at non-tenders, we had 56 players non-tendered this season or after this season. It was 41 the year before. So no matter how you look at it, you include opt-outs and everything else, there's certainly more players going into that pool. And I do think we'll have to see, you know, it's interesting to me that this is all happening when we're also adding one more player to the active roster, right? We talked about the 26th man a lot over the offseason, and then obviously other things have overshadowed and there are other roster decisions that are more pressing. But I mean, part of me hopes that maybe just even that one more job per team, the fact that there are 30 more jobs could help in some way. But I don't think that's quite enough to, you know, counteract these sorts of effects in terms of decision making that, you know, that you're referring to.
No, and I think that teams will use that pool to reduce cost. In other words, if you had a pitcher like Syndergaard who's going to make $10 million, maybe teams say, you know what? We'll just pluck one of the $2 million guys out and save ourselves $8 million. And that the whole issue of supply and demand is really going to work against the players. All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this. Good to talk with you. Stay safe.
Thank you so much, Buster. You too.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Monday. First up, we've got Hood Hoodie at Hood Hoodie 2. He writes in, modern statistical analysis really shines a light on what an underappreciated player Jimmy Winn was. Without modern stats, which player or players would have remained the most underappreciated?
Yeah, two guys jump to mind. Dwight Evans, who I think there's no reason now why he shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame, the former Red Sox Orioles outfielder, 8 gold gloves, 2,446 hits. And 1,391 walks. He was a big on-base percentage guy in his time. 385 homers. He was an outstanding player who I think using modern metrics would have been far more valued than he was in his time. And the Tigers' Lou Whitaker, the second baseman, he drew 1,197 walks. He had more walks and strikeouts in his career, 244 homers, 3 gold gloves. I think they were underappreciated because of how statistics were used.
Our pal Debbie Gammons Brown writes in, the story around Albert Bell's corked bat reminds us that there's always been cheating in baseball. Do you think that will change in the wake of the sign stealing scandal whenever baseball returns?
No, I think that'll always be there. Like, players will always be looking for an advantage. It just depends on the circumstances. I do think that there probably will be, initially anyway, a reduction in the effort to steal signs and to cheat via technology.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we talked to Shane Victorino last week, he almost reveled in the fact that the Mets were such good sign stealers and that they cheated so well. So if that's the attitude amongst baseball players, I'm with you there. Last one for today, AJ Leyenberger writes in, and this is, you know, our completely hypothetical scenario with a purely speculative answer, I'm sure, but what is the shortest length you think the season could be in 2020 before the entire season is canceled?
I think the absolute shortest period, and to reiterate, this is complete speculation, would be some kind of end of year tournament, like an NCAA like tournament where everyone's just trying to make the best of a bad situation. And let's say the go time came at the beginning of October where teams could actually consider playing. I think at that point, you might want to think about having some kind of a tournament, because to have a regular season of 20 games would seem kind of silly to me. I think the like a late year tournament would draw a lot of interest. What do you think?
Oh my God, yeah, that would be. I mean, I've spent a lot of time just thinking about like, oh, when's the first game of anything that I can watch? Is I've seen some crazy scenarios out there. I know the Premier League is thinking about basically like locking down all of the players, coaches, everyone that would need to be, you know, around to put on a broadcast of a game and having them all kind of like live in these camps essentially to finish their season. So, I'm salivating over whatever we can get. And, you know, if it turns into some sort of wacky bracket style tournament, I mean, that'd be good for me. I would love it personally.
Yeah. And again, I think it's going to be a case where whatever they can get, they will grab for it.
For sure. That does it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. We had a couple people, including AJ Leyenberger, you know, write in like, oh, you know, longtime listener, first time writing in a question. So if you've never written in a question before, now's the time to do it. We got all kinds of time to answer them. So please do that. Subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. We have a ton of great interviews up. If you haven't caught up, some listeners were writing in saying how they were binge listening over the weekend on their bike ride or their run. So if you haven't checked any out, that could be a good time to run through a few of those. And we teased last week that we would have this gentleman on today, but tomorrow we will be joined by Daryl Strawberry. That'll be a good one for certain.
Yeah, and one of the things that I posed to Daryl when we taped with him, and we'll run that again on Tuesday, he played on two of the greatest teams of all time, the 1986 Mets and the 1998 Yankees, and he has a very distinct choice of which team he thinks is better, which I found to be really interesting. So listen for that tomorrow. That's it for today. My thanks to Kyle Peterson, to Sarah Langs, and to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.